And we want to welcome you to the Sansan session. This is number 124. Make sure everybody's in the right session. This is Digital Dutch Saints. Today is August 7th, 2008. I'm Ron Romig. I work at Community Christ as the church archivist, and that's in Independence, Missouri, and I'm happy to have the privilege of sharing his chair for this session. The session will explore the digital, multilingual, multicultural, progressive, ecumenical dialogue now being facilitated by the Dutch Mormons for Peace and Justice on their website, Mormonen voor Vrede. Before we begin, we will ask those in the audience to please turn off any potential noise-making devices. Our present situation is that we have Robert Port and Brian Monte as presenters today. Robert is a Dutchman living with his family in the Las Vegas Lone Mountain ward of the LDS Grand Canyon stake. Robert is a flight attendant, allowing him to interact with the larger restoration tradition worldwide. Robert is the editor of the Dutch-oriented internet website known as MVG Mormonen voor Vrede. Robert and Brian collaborate produce a bilingual web blog, Restorations, Hell...
Herstellingen,
thank you. As a reflection of the Latter-day spirituality as expressed through the LDS and Community of Christ. Brian Armonte is a lecturer in English language and culture at Fontes University in the Netherlands. He attends the Rotterdam Community of Christ congregation and serves as a tour guide during summers at the Community of Christ Temple in Independence, Missouri. He has co-written Mormonen voor Vrede, monthly web blog with Robert, since November 2007. Brian, will you tell us the web address?
Robert, why don't you do that? You know the web address better. Mormonen voor Vrede, Connecticut, with Herstellingen. That is the web address.
www.mdgcontact.org. That's it.
Yeah.
It's on the screen somewhere, too.
It'll be on the tape after
that. Right.
Oh, okay.
Also, Brian is a scholar and author currently in search of a publisher for a work of biographical poems about Joseph Smith family. Following Robert and Brian's presentations, we will have time for questions. And we will begin with Robert, followed by Brian.
Goedemorgen, dames en heren, broeders en zusters. Broeders en zusters, dames en heren.
Good morning.
That's about as much as Dutch I will say for right now. And we welcome you. My name is Robert, and you've heard a little bit about us already. We will further introduce ourselves a little later in this session, but by way of introduction, Brian Monte will now read a passage from the Doctrine and Covenants. Mm-hmm.
Een slag van Christus, u naam gegeven als een goddelijke zegen, is uw identiteit en roeping. Als het in haar vol betekenis wilt bespeuren en aanvaarden, zult u niet alleen uw toekomst ontdekken, maar zult u een zegen zijn voor de gehele schepping. Wees niet bevreesd te gaan waar het nu naar toe loont te gaan.
Jezus Christus. Brian,
ja.
What are you doing?
I'm reading a section from the Doctrine and Covenants.
Oh, but it's in Dutch, right?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Which section did you say?
Section
163. I do apologize here because, of course, every 14-year-old LDS seminary student knows there is no section 163 in the Doctrine and Covenants, right? So we need to clarify this a little bit. What did you read about?
Well, I'm reading about the latest section from President Steve Deasy to the Community of Christ in the Doctrine and Covenants.
163, all right. Well, never heard of it, but nevertheless, I guess we'll explore a little further. Why don't you introduce yourself a little to everybody?
Well, my name is Brian Monte, and I've been living in the Netherlands for almost 16 years now. And Robert and I met last year at the presentation here at Sunstone on Harvest Hills. And after that time, we've been communicating with each other in a monthly weblog about different issues for Latter-day Saints and people in the Community of Christ, especially those who have Dutch roots. So that's what this presentation is about today.
You're going to have to come to the other side, Brian, because you're in the projector.
Okay. So, what we're going to do is we're going to talk about our blog on Mormons for Faith and Correctigheid website. That's Mormons for Peace and Justice. And as Robert said, that website is at mvgcontact.org/restorationshtm. Now, the blog, as I said, was begun in November 2007, and we've introduced ourselves who we are as bloggers, and we have a couple pictures of Rotterdam there for you to see what a little bit of the scenery looks like. Next slide, please. The overview of the presentation has a lot of items in it, but so we're not going to spend a lot of time on all of them. Some we'll just talk about briefly. But first of all, Robert is going to give you a little bit of an idea of the spectrum of the type of beliefs within the Latter-day Saint movement. And that's going to be the part about restorations and polarizations. After that, we'll talk about the church histories and their sources. Then we'll talk about the size and locations of the Dutch churches, adaptations to local culture, a typical COC LDS service. Robert's going to talk about dual spirituality and universal citizenship. And then there'll be sections on incompetence and unison and controversial subjects. If you have any questions, please hold those questions until the end of this session where we'll have a Q&A part. Okay, next slide. Great. So Robert's now going to talk about restorations and polarizations.
There we go. We see some encrypted words there, but I think we recognize the LDS part. Let's go to those words in the middle where it says MLDS. Never heard of that, of course. And RLDS. That's a little more familiar. We thought, why don't we call it MLDS, Mormon Latter-day Saints, right? There are Mormon Latter-day Saints, and they used to be reorganized Latter-day Saints. Of course, it's fair to say that the two main denominations within the Restoration Movement are rapidly moving in opposite directions. Anybody who has been thinking or reading about that is probably aware of that. But as they are moving in opposite directions, not everyone agrees. We're very much aware of that, probably. So, let's look at RLDS, now the Community of Christ. There are also people that didn't feel that was a good thing, that changed. So we call them the rest, the Restorationist, the Remnant Church, I believe. We call them the rest. That word kind of, that abbreviation kind of catches it. They kind of moved in an opposite direction too, what I understand. Same thing is true for Mormon Latter-day Saints. The church kind of wanted to drop the Mormon part. That's not a part that comes over very well in missionary work. So they became LDS, but they're also moving in the direction of conservative mainstream Christianity, may I say. There are some people who don't necessarily like that, and we call them the liberal Mormons, many of which you may find here today. I was thinking, where do they meet? Liberal Mormons, Community of Christ members. There are several of each denomination right here in this little audience here. So Sunstone is a wonderful place for liberal Mormons and certain members of the Community of Christ to meet. It's a wonderful opportunity and a blessing. I've been thinking, where do Latter-day Saints and Restorationists meet? I was thinking, well, maybe at the Republican Convention or the Focus on the Family, that kind of thing, you know, if they want to meet at all, because I'm not sure that they're looking for each other. I understand some a small group of numbers actually do look for some dialogue there, but probably very minor group. So liberal Mormons definitely have a lot of in common with the Community of Christ. Maybe some of you are familiar with the wonderful work of John Charles Duffy. He produced liberalmormon.net. That's the internet address, actually. It's a website about liberal Mormonism, somewhat of a liberal Mormon theology, translated in quite a few languages, one of them in Dutch, where I think many members of the Community of Christ also find concepts that they recognize and can accept, and that's a wonderful thing. So that's where they sort of meet. I did add a a quote from Marcus Borg in The Heart of Christianity, his book, where he defines conservative as the earlier way and liberal as the emerging way. And because words like conservative and liberal, progressive and what have you, are used so often in so many different ways that sometimes that can be very confusing. But I thought Marcus Borg gave a very good contribution by calling it the earlier way and maybe the new way, the emerging way. All right. Thank you, Ron.
Okay, for the next part, what we'll do is we'll give a little bit of an overview of the church histories. Most of my information I've gotten from the COC, the History of the Organized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, Volume 7 and 8, articles in the Saints Herald. Also, Joey Williams, who was the former COC Dutch youth leader, wrote a paper for our church historian. And then there's a book from Bakker, the organizer of the Kerk van Jezus Christus van de Heiligen der Laatste Dagen, and Zwagwesteinde. Zwagwesteinde is probably the biggest congregation in the Netherlands, and that was written in 1986. Also information I've obtained from personal interviews. Could I have the next slide, please? Now, the timeline, we have a common point here when Apostle Orson Hyde traveled through the Netherlands on his way to Jerusalem to dedicate the Holy Land for the beginning of the last dispensation. 1861 was when the first RLDS contact was made in Friesland, and that was Brother E. Jasper, according to the Saints Herald, and he baptized three families in Zaandam and brought one back to Nebraska City, Nebraska at the time. Now, unfortunately, there wasn't a lot of missionary work in the Netherlands between 1861 and 1921, but then President Frederick M. Smith, grandson of Joseph Smith Jr., visited Schiedam, and he baptized three people. Then in 1922, the first long-term RLDS missionaries were sent, and the first Rotterdam branch was organized. In the 1920s and 1930s, the Rotterdam branch had open-air preaching and singing at Rosenpark in Rotterdam. And in 1937, the Zwagwesteinde branch in Friesland was organized. In 1938, there was a debate between the LDS and the RLDS in Zwagwesteinde. And then the next slide, please. During the war, there wasn't much work done at all, and that had to do with if you were an able-bodied male, you probably ended up being taken away to work in a factory in Germany, so there wasn't much going on in the Dutch church at the time. However, when people returned, there were 51 baptisms in Zwagwesteinde in 5 years, so that was a period of dramatic growth. In the 1950s, a new congregation was formed in Leeuwarden. In 1958, the Rotterdam church building was dedicated. 1966, the Zwagwesteinde church building. And this year, we'll be holding our 50th anniversary of the Rotterdam church building. And that shows you a picture of people at the 2008 Dutch Easter reunion, which is held at Easter time. This year, it was rather early in March. Okay, Robert, I think you're up next with the LDS church history and sources.
All right, we moved through this rather quickly because we realized that historical information, you know, is not easy to digest. So there isn't really written a whole lot about the history of both churches in the Netherlands, since the groups of people who were supposed to produce that were very small, sometimes not overly eager to do so. And, of course, everything came from the United States for both churches. So local initiatives were sometimes not encouraged, sometimes not taken. There are, like, Ferdy Gelijnse. He is a Dutch scientist, not LDS or Community of Christ, wrote a lengthy Dutch thesis about the reasons why the churches went their own way in Dutch. Very interesting, by the way. And we have it on our website. And there's more. The one at the bottom, Horizon, in Dutch, Horizon, was a magazine, really unique because it never happened before and never happened after that. It was there for about 5 years. Very, very high-quality magazine with dialogue and what have you, and was produced by Professor Wilfried de Koo, the father of Ellen, who's with us today. And but that was really something special. But after that, it never happened again. And by LDS church authorities, it was not very much appreciated either, because obviously this was local. This was a local initiative that invited dialogue, which wasn't pushed at the time. There we go. Well, we'll go through that quickly, too. The first LDS baptism happened in 1861. And I think we can click on that first link where it says monument. You think that will work? It's okay, we can skip it too. The first three people were baptized 1861, and of course with the ideal of Zion, everybody was basically encouraged to leave. Right now there are about 8,000 LDS members in the Netherlands. Most generations that were active and took initiative left for Zion, and that was of course very hard for the church locally to develop, because there was this constant draw on people who wanted to do anything. It was a very dramatic time where it says 1864 on a sailboat to Zion. It sounds very romantic, but of course it wasn't. A lot of kids died, just like the whole trek to Zion over the prairies. We can look at beautiful movies, but once you're there, it doesn't look that great anymore, right? Of course, 2002, the first LDS temple in the Netherlands, in the city of Soetermeer, which in English means Sweet Lake City, as opposed to Salt Lake City. And that's pretty much it for the history of the LDS Church in the Netherlands. All right. Well, as we mentioned, there are about 7,000-8,000 LDS members in the Netherlands and in the Flemish part of Belgium. About 35 wards. I think they have about 40 buildings. And now there's a temple, of course. Just as in general worldwide, the Community of Christ is significantly smaller in numbers. So it is in the Netherlands, only 330 members in four congregations, basically, three in a group. The sad thing is, in the Netherlands, both these churches are incredibly small, but yet there is no dialogue or even visiting whatsoever. Hence our initiative. But that is very typical. If you were LDS, you didn't even mention that other church, you know. And I'm sure the Community of Christ or the former reorganized church, there were sentiments like that as well, you know. Those were things we would rather not discuss. And both Ryan and I feel, why not? Why not use the best of two worlds?
Well, this next slide that we see uses a little bit about what the Dutch COC church is like. It's very ecumenical in some of its approaches. It has a Samen op Weg hymn book, which is used by a lot of the other Protestant churches in the Netherlands, in addition to Hymns of the Saints, which is a standard church hymnal. We also have a quarterly publication called Mededelingblad instead of the monthly English Herald. And this contains some translated articles from English into Dutch, and it comes out quarterly, along with the news for what's going on in the Dutch mission. Also, you'll be surprised in the architecture, there's a lot of similarities. There's clear story windows in both the LDS ward in Rotterdam and in the ward in the congregation building in Rotterdam for the COC church. You've got porthole windows, yellow, green, orange, stained glass. But something that's different about the Community of Christ, of course, is the church seal, which is above the door there with the lion, the lamb, the little child from Isaiah. And we do use crucifixes on the church spire, in the chapel, and also near the baptismal font floor. Okay, next slide. And there's a mural as you go into the Rotterdam church, which a lot of people might not really see when they go there. It's right by the door as you go in. It has five biblical stories or themes, and it was painted in the late 1950s when the church was dedicated. It also includes, in the font, we have early Christian symbols, a fish tile, and the Roman crosses there as part of the architecture. Next slide, please. Okay, here's the mural in detail, and you might, from an LDS background, notice some similarities in some of the themes of these different panels. Now, going from right to left, we have creation, we have expulsion from paradise, the nativity of Christ, crucifixion and redemption, and the future peaceful kingdom. And it used a lot of Native American colors, which refer to the Book of Mormon. And all the panels are linked together there. I sort of stitched them together digitally there because it was difficult to get a picture of the whole thing. Next slide, please. Okay, let's look at the creation slide first of all, the creation panel. Above, you've got the stars and planets shot through with parallel lines of light, symbolizing the light of creation. In the middle, you've got dark and light circles, which are about night and day. And at the bottom, you've got waves, fish, and sea creatures. Next slide. Next is the expulsion from paradise, the round head of an angel with a flaming sword. So the sword with the flames are those little points of light that come up, that go out. And then in the middle, you've got Adam and Eve, their heads facing each other. And at the bottom, you can clearly see the snake and the apple. Okay, the next one. And then we have Nativity, the Star of Bethlehem, right and left, angels with trumpets and horns, and at the bottom, shepherds with their staffs and the crib. After that comes Crucifixion and Redemption. You can't see it in this slide, but above there are the Greek initials J and R for Christ, and the Roman initials right, I-N-R-I, for Jesus Christ, King of the Jews, on the left. Left and right, you've got grapes and bread. In the center, you've got the chalice of the Last Supper, and the right, a loaf of bread, and at the bottom, you have the foot of the cross. And the last panel is about the future peaceful kingdom. Above left to below right, the beams of God's eternal light. In the middle, doves and grapes, symbolic of peace. Right, angels with trumpets and horns. And left, the lion, the lamb, and the child from Isaiah again. Now, these three symbols I can't really make out myself, but the artist says that they merge together into each other. Okay, next slide. Now, as part of our work here with the COC and with the LDS, we visited each other's churches. And this is a picture of the LDS First and Second Ward in Rotterdam. And it has some unique church architecture and artwork also, but no photos are permitted inside the meeting house, so I'll just have to describe them to you here. One of them is a painting in the chapel of Joseph Smith's first vision, and it has him literally bowled over from his encounter with the divine, and that's a painting. And then you've got, again, the yellow, orange, pink, and purple translucent window panes and the clear story windows, reminiscent of the Dutch Reformed churches. And you see that influence actually in both buildings a bit. And, of course, you've got the ball ornament on the church spire, which is also a standard Dutch ornamentation that you usually find on spires. Okay, and at this point, we're going to talk about those visits. First, Robert is going to talk about his... Well, actually, I guess I'm up first, sorry. First, I'll talk about the Rotterdam Second Ward visit that I made in February. And then Robert will talk about his visit to the Los Angeles congregation. So let me pull that up for you here and put my reading glasses on. In the spirit of the restoration of this restoration forum, I visited the Second Rotterdam Ward of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints on 17 February 2008. This ward and its building is located in the center of Rotterdam, a five-minute walk from the Rotterdam Block Dutch Railway Station. As I emerged from this underground station, the first thing I noticed were the yellow blocks of the Cubus Woninga, stacked on their points, not on their sides, which visually seem about to tumble down into the street, one of the many modern buildings in Rotterdam. Most of the center of Rotterdam is new because it was bombed by the Germans in 1940 to force the Dutch to capitulate. This gave the impetus after the war for many organizations and churches to rebuild the city, as did the Latter-day Saints when they built a chapel in Oost-Einderstraat in the city center in 1954, and the Community of Christ, then known as the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, in Groenesoom in Frederik in 1958. When I arrived at the LDS chapel about 1:15 in the afternoon, the Priesthood and Relief Society were conducting their meetings. I found the general priesthood meeting in the chapel. A group of around 20 men were sitting in the left-hand side pews, listening for their assignments. I sat towards the back and looked around at the building's architecture and decor. The chapel has second-story clear-story windows, typical of the Dutch Reformed style. And it's also filled with rows of old, worn wooden benches. I would estimate that it could seat approximately 200 to 300 people. On the rostrum in the front are the traditional semicircle rows of theater-style seats for meeting presiders and the choir. What I found most unusual in this building, which I mentioned before, was the painting of Joseph Smith literally bowled over by his encounter with the divine that hangs on the left-hand side of the chapel. I was later informed by one of the ward attendees that this painting was a notable exception to the traditional non-iconographic decor of Mormon chapels. I just unzipped my coat when I was asked by the leader of the priesthood meeting to introduce myself. After the general meeting, I was invited by some of the older priesthood members to attend a meeting of 8 to 10 men between the ages of 30 to 70, during which they discussed the testimony of Joseph Smith church curriculum, which I read about in Sunstone magazine. The group discussed the circumstances surrounding the translation of the Book of Mormon, how it was translated, where it was translated, what was included on the plates that were translated, etc.
The text emphasizes that the Book of Mormon is the slouch stone, the keystone of the Mormon religion. One of the priesthood members, Brother Roberts, an American living in the Netherlands, generously shared his copy of this book with me so that I could read on with the others. Between priesthood and Sunday school class, Brother Roberts asked me some questions about my background as we stood in the church's front lobby. He asked me if I was from the Community of Christ, and I said I was. He asked me about my motivation for my visit, and I said I was a researcher investigating the different restoration congregations and wards in the Netherlands. Next, I was invited to attend Sunday school, and it was suggested that I go to the investigators class, which Brother Roberts attended with me. There I found 10 people, about 6 people of color, including one of the 2 missionary sisters and 2 Dutchmen, one of whom was a native speaker elder who helped the 2 sisters get through their explanation of the plan of salvation in Dutch. Lots of scripture references were given, and thick, well-worn scriptures were used to search for passages related to the afterlife and the 3 degrees of glory. I shared the sister missionaries' discomfort as they struggled to pronounce the difficult Dutch word for the veil, sluier, I think it is in Dutch, which separates this world from the next. At the end of the class, one of the sister missionaries asked the investigators to pray for a testimony about the plan of salvation that they had just spent the last 3/4 of an hour describing. After Sunday school class came the sacrament service. It was here I noticed the significant presence of people of color in the ward, of Portuguese and or Afro-Caribbean descent, who comprised approximately 15 to 20% of the approximately 15 attendees. Here, 2 younger ward members read stories and gave their testimonies. A boy who couldn't have been more than 12 struggled to read a passage from Joseph Smith's and Oliver Cowdery's ordination into the Aaronic priesthood. It was probably his first time at the microphone, and when he was finished, he was relieved to go back and sit down next to his mother in one of the chapel's pews. The second young woman got up and read her mother's testimony about her battle with kidney disease and how her father had donated the kidney to someone else so that her mother would receive one in return. The last speaker was Brother Roberts, who said that the message of the gospel is quite simple: to choose to do good and not evil. Whilst listening to the talks and testimonies, I was reminded of how tactile Latter-day Saints are during sacrament meeting, how mothers and fathers hold their children to keep them quiet and or show their affection. I watched some very young children towards the front of the chapel play quietly under the pews. I also saw a mother gently lift up her daughter's long hair from the back of her neck and a young father roll a pram back and forth in one of the sanctuary aisles. In addition, I noticed that there were many more empty seats in the chapel than those that were filled, something which is also true of the Community of Christ congregation I attend in Rotterdam. During the sacrament meeting, as Robert Port mentioned in his report about the Las Vegas Community of Christ congregation, the same prayers were said over the bread and water in the LDS church as in the CFC church. As I took the bread and the water, I was grateful for the opportunity to share communion with my LDS cousins. I also prayed for the mother and father of the young woman who spoke, and that someday, somehow, all the churches of the Restoration would be able to join together in the great work that still lies before us.
And yes, I did visit the Community of Christ in Las Vegas, where I lived with my family. And just to give you an idea what that is like, Las Vegas is very much desert. I always call it the backyard of desert. It's a huge city. There are 18 LDS stakes, which holds about 100,000 Latter-day Saints. Here's this one small chapel, somewhat in the center of town. And there were about 30 members coming to not sacrament meeting, but to the Sunday service. So you couldn't get a bigger contrast there, right? Yet I was welcomed. They asked me to stand up and introduce myself. It was very nice for me as a Latter-day Saint. It was very obvious there were some changes, different things too. The people in charge were all women, and there were some songs that I recognized. Actually, we all sang "Like a Fire, the Spirit is Burning."
Spirit of God, like a fire is burning.
Like a fire. Okay, and we know the equivalent in Dutch as well. Very famous restoration song, so to speak. I was happy to hear that. It was the first Sunday of the month, so there was communion. And I was going to take it anyway, but I understand the Community of Christ does have an official open communion policy, so to speak, which means that everybody is more than welcome to participate in that. And I believe in among Latter-day Saints that is not yet officially so, but in practice, everybody, including very small children, actually, partake in the sacrament.
They let me do it in Rotterdam. So
regardless, everybody partakes of the sacrament. It's a wonderful thing. I felt very much at home there. I recognized many things that I found in my own ward. Some things were different, but nothing was of a nature that I wouldn't be able to enjoy. People were open. They were interested why I was there, and I explained it to them. And I've been back many times since. And that probably brings us to our next part, one of our main parts of this presentation, where we like to introduce to you the concept of dual spirituality as universal spiritual citizens in Zion. As you read in the introduction, Brian Monty is an American citizen living in the Netherlands, member of the Community of Christ. I'm somewhat mirroring him. I'm a Dutchman, permanent resident in the United States, member of I'm a Latter-day Saint. And I think I can also say I am straight. Brian is gay. So we are like, you know, the same thing, but then different, sort of. So, which brought me to the idea, historically and traditionally, Latter-day Saints and members of the reorganized church, as it used to be, I mean, there was not much dialogue there. People did not feel the need to come together, rather the opposite. People were trying to stay out of each other's way. As I experience the things that I learn in the Community of Christ in Las Vegas, sometimes I go to San Francisco too as I work there, I was wondering why that is. And of course we understand why that is. There are numerous historical reasons to mention why people do not talk to each other, theological differences and so on. But especially for Brian and me, this is a moment in time where we can probably abridge the two. If you would ask me, are you an American or a Dutchman, I would have to think about that. I met my wife in the early 70s. She's a Tongan from Tonga in California. We lived in Holland for 20 years, raised our family there, 5 kids, now 8 grandkids. But if you would ask me, are you a Dutchman or American, I would have to think about that, you know. Give it some time and nobody knows the difference. And in some ways that's true for Brian. We talked about that this morning sometime. We see some beautiful things in the Netherlands, some ugly things over there. Basically every culture has some beautiful things and some ugly things, no exception. And once you know that, and once you become comfortable to move from one to the other, we travel a lot between the United States and of America and the Netherlands, it really is home. Both of them are home to us. And that could be a wonderful concept to be applied as members of cousins in the Restoration. I put some Dutch sentences there. It says, Liefde overwint alles, just to show how close the Dutch language actually is to English. Did you know that the Dutch language is the closest, linguistically spoken, closest language to English? And it kind of shows, love overwins, conquers everything. God is love, right? God is Liefde. We can talk about the Zonen van Jozef and the Dochters van Emma. The sons of Joseph and the daughters of Emma. I like to, in that regard, call Latter-day Saints the sons of Joseph, the more masculine type, you know. Strength in numbers, bigger is better. And the daughters of Emma, maybe somewhat more petite, but and more feminine. And it shows. And nevertheless, siblings. So, with those stereotype differences, we can still appreciate each other. When I look at my sisters, I'm 1 out of 7 in the Netherlands. I have 4 sisters. Yeah, they're very different in every respect, but they're my sisters, you know? We grew up together. And maybe we can see each other within the Restoration Movement like that as well. I put some Dutch words there. Did you know that Yankees is a Dutch word? Jan and Kees are two very common male names in Holland. and they were prevalent in the New York area, New Amsterdam area, and those people were quickly called Yankees. That's where it comes from. There's another Dutch word, not so beautiful, we all know it, apartheid. This could be the topic of an entire presentation here at Sunstone, how the Boers, the descendants from the Dutch in South Africa, have many, many, many similarities with Latter-day Saint history. Think about pioneer trek. They were chased by the British, isolated. And because of the isolation, they kind of locked themselves up in their theology. They justified racism based on the Bible. They knew where to find it. So, do you see the similarities here, you know? So, apartheid, Dutch word, not so beautiful. There are Dutch presidents, Roosevelt, very sympathetic for the Dutch because he was the one that basically liberated the Netherlands from the Nazis. But then there's this other Dutch president of Dutch descent from the New York area, Van Buren. He actually spoke fluent Dutch. But he was the president, if you know your Restoration history, that refused Joseph Smith or the Latter-day Saints in Nauvoo the protection they needed. So basically a Dutch president was indirectly responsible for our separation, so to speak. Bottom line is ecumenical interfaith kind of resembles the joy of being comfortable living in two nations. And that's our bottom line. Both Brian and I, we have that experience, and maybe you do too in many ways. I know for sure Ellen, who's from Antwerp, Belgium, but going to school and living part of the year in Provo, has that same experience, you know? You come to appreciate both, you become aware of the weaknesses of both, and why not? Why not take it all in? Human nature so quickly decides to choose for one or the other, and always looking for opposites. But why not enjoy the best of two worlds? Indeed, what could be more proper and loving than transforming the feelings that Emma and Joseph had for each other into a mutually inclusive formula for us as their offspring? To approach each other in confidence and unison. And that phrase comes from a remark Joseph Smith, I think, put in his diary, where he reflected on his marriage with Emma and how their feelings, mutual feelings, were feelings of confidence and unison. And what would be more natural to hold on to that, you know, regardless what other people try to do to keep us apart. There is a picture, maybe we can, is it possible to click to that? Is that doable?
Could get there, but it would
forget it. Maybe you've seen it before. It's a beautiful painting of Joseph and Emma, I think, on a bed with beautiful gilts. Is that how you say it? Gilts? Gilts. Quilts. 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 That's one of those words I can't pronounce. And you see them there very lovingly with two of their kids, the twins, I'm not sure. And I like to think those two kids is child LDS and child Community of Christ. And there was no difference there. They were equally loved by their parents. What a joy they were. And that's how they envisioned their lives. And what have we made out of it? You know, are we still talking to our siblings? Hopefully we are. Sometimes my wife makes a joke and says, yeah, we as Latter-day Saints, we go to great lengths to take care of our dead ancestors, but do we talk to our living relatives, you know? Mind you, she's a Polynesian, where family is the big thing, right? But she notices that we sometimes go at great lengths to communicate with our dead ancestors, but not include our living family. So yeah, let's operate in confidence and unison, and just overcome that that fear to visit each other, to talk to each other, to engage in dialogue, and then soon find out that indeed the LDS Church and the Community of Christ are moving in opposite directions. Was it Bill Russell who mentioned that, what was the phrase, greater differences, but...
Oh yeah, closer friends, bigger differences.
Closer friends, bigger difference, or bigger differences, and therefore... closer friends, because we don't have to nitpick about the details anymore. It's clear. Okay, moving in opposite directions. And for me personally, and hopefully for Brian too, that gives us the opportunity to, just as living in two nations, freely move from one to the other, freely introduce new concepts that we learn from each other. And some people may not agree, but we'll do it nevertheless, because it's really a joy to be able to go to two places and enjoy the best of those two worlds.
Okay, and some of the unique features of the Community of Christ. Well, first of all, we're, I think, pretty much all aware that women can be ordained if they have a calling in the Community of Christ. And this happened since, well, I've had different dates for this. 1986 is the one the former church historian gave me, and then I've heard one of November 1985 when the first ordinations took place. So somewhere in there. And in the Netherlands, two out of three congregations are led by women. And if you see the photo there in front of you, we had an ordination on the 6th of April, 2008. That's Johannes Egbert Kaltema, who's now the youth leader in the Netherlands for the Dutch Church. And on the left there is Annette Compier. In the middle is Martin van Klinken. And to the right is Geesje van Klinken, his mother. And they're ordaining Johannes to the office of priest. Also in the Community of Christ Church, there's a lot of dialogue at the moment about homosexuality in the priesthood. Now, Bill Russell knows all about this because he has a new book out called Homosexual Saints. So, if you want to read up on this, just talk to Bill. Do you have any books?
I bought the books
with him. So he's got the book there right in front of him. This was just published recently in the last few months, and I had the chance to read it when I came to Independence in July.
I'd like to say that I designed the cover. But I did it in live. It's a beautiful cover.
Yes, it is. It's very colorful, so you can't miss it. Now, the problem with homosexuality in the Community of Christ Church for some people, it's not a problem for me, I'm gay and I'm a member of the Community of Christ, is that there was a standing high council decision in 1982 that was taken that only celibate gays are allowed, or lesbians or bisexuals are allowed to be ordained. And many people in the church who are gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transsexual don't agree with this. So we've been trying to get things changed. There have been listening circles since the 1990s to the present to try to reach out to people in the church to try to have them understand what it's like to be gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transsexual. However, in 2002, and this information on the slide is incorrect because after reading Bill's book, I figured out what the real story was. It wasn't that a decision was taken at World Conference in 2002, but it was a decision of the Standing High Council and the Presidency, I believe, and Church Leadership Council in September 2002, where they upheld the decision again. So some people would call this a moratorium on ordinations, because some ordinations were done during the latter part of Wallace B. Smith's presidency and also the beginning of Grant McMurray's. And other people would call this, well, that would be the moratorium because it was started one time. Others of us would say it's a ban because it's not happening anymore. If you haven't received your first priesthood call and you're openly gay or lesbian, you're not being called in your congregation. I haven't heard of any calls as there were for women in Australia in the 1960s or in the center stake in the 1970s. So it pretty much looks like a ban at the moment. Now, what's it like in the Netherlands to be gay or lesbian? Well, I went to Annette Compier's graduation party, the young woman on the left there, and I was there with my partner Winfred, and we've been together for over 9 years now. And Winfred's analysis was, well, these people accept us. Some of them only tolerate us, but we're accepted. We can take part in what's going on. He was also there when I gave a presentation on Sunstone, which I did last year on Harvest Hills at Sunstone. I gave that to the congregation, and everyone gave him a nice warm handshake, and they're very friendly towards us. However, once again, that does mean that of the two of the eight ordinances or sacraments in the church, LGBT people do not qualify to be married, to have the sacrament of marriage, or to be ordained.
And of course, as we will talk later on about the fact that why was Brian Monty in the Netherlands? Because, as most people know, the political and legal climate in the Netherlands is very liberal compared to, let's say, what's going on in the United States. And for anyone who ever reads a newspaper, you can read there's a lot of criticism about liberalism in politics in Europe, and especially in the Netherlands. I heard one of my colleagues says, yeah, you guys have the culture of death. She was pointing to abortion rights and euthanasia. So that wasn't a very long conversation, by the way. But I can see where they come from. But at the same time, and maybe especially when you live there, you kind of start to see things very different. Like, say, the drug laws are very liberal in the Netherlands. But most Latter-day Saints totally agree with that policy because they know from first-hand experience that it works. And also historically, the Pilgrim Fathers, they started out from Delfshaven in Holland because they were tolerated there. Even in the time of polygamy in Utah, there were people who were trying to crack down on the small church in the Netherlands, but the parliament wouldn't have it because they said that does not stroke with our idea of liberty. So liberal political climate is very very valuable. It also sometimes seems that Europeans and the Dutch and the Danish are overly focused on sex. I beg to differ. I think they have somewhat developed a healthy outlook on all things sexual, where that is still a problem, especially in Utah or in the larger United States, where, and we'll hear it later in one of our Sunson presentations, I believe somebody will be talking about morality, which almost always is a code word, so to speak, for sexuality, I believe, in the LDS Church at least. And Dutch Latter-day Saints do notice that, and they see the difference, and they sometimes wonder why other problems like violence, pollution, and poverty in politics are totally ignored. It's always a problem with something sexual, be it homosexual or abortion. There seems to be a overly focused on all things sexual by the church, the LDS Church. Well, we didn't have a picture, too bad, because she's beautiful. Beautiful LDS member Cheryl Baas was chosen as Miss Netherlands 2006. And just to make the point here again, the best of two worlds, she was half Dutch, half Filipino. You can just imagine a beautiful young lady. And too bad we don't have the pictures. There, too, the Dutch are very open, not easily shocked, and to celebrate the human body. And you can see a difference there, too, in the church in the Netherlands as well, I think. All right.
So now we have a period of Q&A with some FAQs about number of members and missionaries, Book of Mormon, Word of Wisdom, tithing, marriage, and temples. But I'd like to get to your question first. Your name is Nadine, is it? Okay, could you repeat your question for me? Actually, anyone can go up to the microphone now if they'd like to ask some questions.
My question was, in the Community of Christ, what happens if you're gay and celibate and then later you get a partner?
Well, Bill probably has a lot of cases about this in his book, Homosexual Saints. I believe there was one woman in Nauvoo who was married and straight for a while, and then she became a lesbian. And as a result of her relationship becoming open, that she was silenced.
Yep. Okay. Could you explain what that means?
That means you're no longer allowed to preach in church, I believe, right? You can attend, but you're not allowed to preach.
No longer a priesthood member in good standing.
No longer a priesthood member in good standing. Okay, anyone else have a question related to what we've talked about or any of these topics up here? Yes. Could you go to the microphone, please, sir?
As the Community of Christ in the Netherlands shifted to de-emphasize restorationist concepts, was that an issue for the saints in the Netherlands? Was that a divisive thing, or was that a comfortable transition?
Actually, we're quite good at getting along with everybody in the Netherlands, getting along with other Protestant and Catholic churches, for example. A lot of people in the church are converts from Protestant and Catholic churches. So
are
it's
there
very.
Restees in your congregation?
Are there restorationists? Not that I know of, no. For example, yeah, theological issues that would probably cause churches weeks and weeks of discussion. They read the letter and they go, okay, can we go on with the service now? Because basically, everybody has a really strong identity in the community of Christ, and they feel that that's their home. So we're more sort of inclusive as much as possible than trying to exclude people. Next question. We do have the Book of Mormon as one of our scriptures. If you read the Maida Dalingblatt, which I brought with me, as part of the lectionary, there's one Book of Mormon scripture for each week. There's Old Testament, New Testament, one Book of Mormon scripture, one Doctrine and Covenant scripture. So we do read the Book of Mormon. Word of wisdom. It's a little bit more liberal in Europe. People drink coffee there. I was surprised when I first went there on a service mission in 78, but that's also an adaptation to local culture. So if you drink coffee, you do not lose your priesthood in the Netherlands or in Germany or some other European countries. Or here either, yeah. That's all right. Go ahead. Phyllis, go ahead.
If you lived here, being like practicing gay man, would you lose your priesthood?
Well, first of all, I'm not a member of the priesthood. So in some respects, that's a disadvantage and advantage. So, for example, as far as silencing is concerned, I don't have to worry about that. And good thing, because I have a really big mouth. So I just visited I believe it's the congregation closest to where I'm looking for a house right now in Independence. And I told them about who I am and about my partner, Winfred, and like to know, are you a real welcoming congregation? And they went out of their way to make me feel welcome, invited me after services to the potluck and everything. I've got an appointment with the pastor to talk to her when I go back to Independence next week. So looks good from my perspective.
Two questions. Are you aware of similar kinds of contacts, collaborations between the two communities? And do you have any advice for anybody who's thinking in those terms?
Well, as a temple guide, I see lots of Mormon groups come through the temple. And the last week or so, for example, there was a young man in his teens with his parents. And when I started telling them about the building and what it's used for, this guy was all folded up, right? And I said, this is a building dedicated to the pursuit of peace and reconciliation. I want you to feel at home here. I want you to experience peace while you're in this building. If I say anything that takes you out of your comfort zone, please let me know. But I reach out to people that way. There's a big stained glass window of the field is white, all ready to harvest. I said, okay, you've had your scripture chase lessons in seminary. Let's hear it. Rattle it off now. What's this stained glass window about? And they do. And it's a wonderful moment that in that piece of holy ground that the two parts of the restoration can come together. And I've seen it happen. And that's part of the ministry of the temple, actually, that happens.
As I read sections 162 and 163 of the Community of Christ Doctrine and Covenants, in a sense I was inspired and I felt very hopeful that progress would be made or continue to be made in terms of the role of gay, lesbian, transgender people in the church. I was wondering if you could comment on that. That's your sense also.
Well, 163 is a very hopeful document. It talks about diversity and about celebrating diversity and about living together peacefully. I've made it sort of like my mission to contact as many of the leaders of the church as possible about the LGBT issue. And there's people in GALA also, which is the COC version of Affirmation that are doing that. And they have talked to the church leaders. They've given them Bill's book. And we've had some discussions, and I hope things are going to continue to move forward, because someone said to me, well, you know, it might be another 20 years before these things change. And I said, 20 years? I'll be 70 by then. I'm not going to wait that long. Things are going to have to change a little bit faster than that, hopefully. So that's my comment on that issue.
I was wondering if I could just explain a little bit about what's happening at the World Church level about the homosexual.
Sure. This is Susan Score speaking. She's one of the apostles in the Community of Christ Church.
Score is Norwegian, actually. Yes. My husband was one quarter Norwegian. Had a chance to go to Norway and visit Score Valley above Bergen in Norway before he died. So that was a really wonderful trip. I thought I would just share with you. you that the conversations about ordination of homosexuals is a very controversial issue in our church, one that has hurt a lot of people. And we are trying to foster dialogue to encourage understanding, and especially for people who do not have any friends who are homosexual, to get to know them and have encounters with them so they understand that these are brothers and sisters in Christ just like we are. That effort of listening circles has not been productive. You need to know that. People have resisted attending those sessions. The ones who attend are usually the ones that don't need to attend because they already are open and understanding. The ones who are closed in their thinking, either pro or anti-homosexual, do not attend. They already know what they are. They don't want to hear any other things happening. What's happening right now is that the presidency, this Standing High Council policy, which actually was intended in 1982 to move the church forward and affirm homosexuals as fully included in our congregations as members, but restrains them from ordination, has some other problems with it. And that document was created by the Standing High Council, given to the First Presidency. It has become policy of the church because the First Presidency indicated their approval and said it's going to be policy of the church. And so we've had this struggle ever since, and this time when a lot of us kind of put aside that policy and tried to ignore it. And there was a tacit understanding that the leaders of the church would kind of turn their head while that policy was put aside. And then in 2002, the World Church Leadership Council, of which I want to point out, I was not a part at that time. I just want to make that statement. I was not there. But that World Church Leadership Council reaffirmed that policy as being the standard of conduct in our church. And so there has been this ban on ordinations of practicing homosexuals ever since. And that's been a difficulty to our brothers and sisters who are homosexual. Now what has happened, and there's a lot of our church members who don't know this, so I'm giving you privileged information, is that the presidency has sent that policy back to the Standing High Council, which is an advisory body. They're not policy making, they're an advisory body, to relook at that policy. They also are sending to them any information and comments they get from people about the homosexual issue for the Standing High Council to review all of that in their decision and discussion and dialogue. Eventually, out of that will come a recommendation to the First Presidency, which the First Presidency will either adopt or ignore or change or whatever, but it will be at least a recommendation from that body of high priests concerning the ordination of homosexuals. I do not know how that dialogue is going, because I'm not part of that Standing High Council. Eventually, I will see whatever that recommendation is, but I will not know until it comes what they are doing, how their dialogue is going. In addition, there are pushes from the membership to make this issue something that is resolved at a local jurisdictional level, that is the mission center level, kind of like a region, rather than one state before all of the World Church, because of the international nature of the problem. If we were to affirm ordination of homosexuals for the global church, the Haiti church, a lot of the African churches, several of the South American churches, and on, would simply walk out. It's illegal in some of those nations to even, you know, be homosexual, and to have that as a policy for all of our global nations would be problematic. So we're pushing, I'm one of those, pushing for this to be resolved at a local level so that we can have a diversity in how that's implemented around the world. Because it's about the only way we're going to get progress in those nations where we have a legal right to make that decision.
Well, thank you, Susan. Now, Robert would like to close with a phrase that he has, a quotation, and then we'll have to end the session.
That is correct. Already we have come to the end of Digital Dutch Saints. Thank you very much, Susan Skor, for those very informative remarks. That was very helpful. And just as we started our presentation this morning with the Doctrine and Covenants, we'll close with a verse from the Doctrine and Covenants in English this time. And I think this is one of the more important verses of the Doctrine and Covenants for all of us, I think, especially in this thought process of being able to be both Latter-day Saints and members of the Community of Christ. It's Doctrine and Covenants, section 165, verse 5a. Do not be defined by the things that separate you, but by the things that unite you in Jesus Christ. Thank you. Tot ziens. En hartelijk dank.